What is kjempetorsk?
Kjempetorsk? That's a big cod, I guess.
That's like a special word, isn't it? Like, Swedes are known to make up fake words in Norwegian.
What? Swedes?
I heard that Swedes are made to make up, like, Swedes.
Kjempetorsk is, in Swedish, is, of course, a pimp, I think. So, yeah.
Like, Swedes have been known to make up fake Norwegian words.
And the other way around, too, maybe.
And I was wondering, have you heard of any of these words? Brus e foil toil.
Yeah, but...
what is that?
In what connection?
Brus e foil toil. Gu le boy.
Does not make any sense.
This is just surreal.
Klumpasnusk.
No idea.
Okay, I guess...
Are these Swedish...
These are Swedish words that are made up, fake Norwegian words.
Well, that explains it.
So what was the other way around, though? What were the Norwegian words that were fake Swedish words?
I don't know. I just made that up.
Lastly here, you guys have the song Renewal.
Yes.
And I was thinking about refreshing and stuff and going up on stage. Have you seen some strange things of people going up on stage? For instance, before somebody goes up on stage, I've seen clips of bands huffing a bag with a dead animal in it for inspiration, like to get the air for inspiration. Have you seen some weird people preparing before they get up to go up on stage, weird rituals?
Not that I can think of right now. We don't really have any sort of that rituals ourselves, but... No.
Like, for instance, we played with Danzig. Was he in the gym before he got up on stage? That sort of stuff, you know.
Maybe it was during the day. I don't know.
And there's a great punk band from Victoria called the Neos, legendary punk band. And them, to prepare to go up on stage, they would jump up and down the stairs wearing sweaters. And then just as they're about to go on stage, they'd whip off the sweaters. They'd be all sweaty and ready to play.
Okay.
Well, that was like the ritual. I guess I was curious if you've seen rituals like that from other bands.
Not really, no. I guess we're just boring in this music business. You know?
Anything else you want to add to the people out there at all?
No. Absolutely not.
Well, thanks so much. Keep on rocking in the free world and do-do-do-do-do-do.
Offering your bastard sons and daughters.
know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Today is Friday, July 8th, 2011. I'm Martin Lemlin, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It's shortly past 5 o'clock, and it's now time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to be talking about supposed illegal actions that have been taking place against the Fight HST campaign, as well as the coroner's report on the unfortunate death of a former UBC student, an odd Mexican jailbreak, as well as a special report from Groundwire Community Radio News, and I speak with James Cronk about this summer's upcoming season of Theater Under the Stars. All this and so much more right here on News 101, your source for local, independent, national, and international news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Court of Appeals today overturned an FCC ruling allowing one company to own a newspaper and broadcast outlet in the same market. The court also ruled the FCC failed to consider the impact of broader media ownership rules on minorities and women. In a release, the plaintiff in the case, Prometheus Radio Project, calls this ruling a victory on almost every point. Hundreds of pro-Palestinian activists are expected to land at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport tomorrow. In response, Israeli authorities have mobilized security forces and have asked foreign airlines to ban the activists from their flights. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore reports from Israel.
Hundreds of activists from across Europe, Africa, and the U.S. plan to fly into Tel Aviv Airport within the next 24 hours. The activists are part of the Welcome to Palestine initiative, which has been planning the action since March. The Israeli media reported Thursday that 600 Israeli police officers will be deployed at the airport. The Israeli Ministry of Interior also reportedly sent letters to airlines asking them to bar activists from flying into Israel. The Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem has been working with the protesters. It released an email sent from a Swiss airline to one of the activists reading, "The Israeli Ministry of the Interior has refused your entry into their territory. For this reason, your reservation has been cancelled." AIC co-director Connie Hackbarth.
I'm horrified that Israel is outsourcing its occupation and that countries such as Canada, Greece, Switzerland are agreeing to take part in continuing the Israeli occupation, in this case by not allowing peace activists to come. I hope that peace activists will turn to their own governments and protest this complicity in the Israeli occupation.
The first of approximately 50 flights carrying the activists are expected to land early Friday morning. Jillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
New information has emerged from investigations into the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Fast and Furious program. The program was intended to track U.S.-sold weapons along the Mexico border in order to secure arrests, but many of the weapons were lost along the way. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
The pretense of the Fast and Furious program was to allow straw purchases of weapons, track the guns, and identify the higher-ups supplying them to crime syndicates in Mexico. Whistleblowing field agents have come forward saying they were ordered not to intervene at moments they thought were critical in preventing future crimes. Since then, several guns traced to the program have been linked to crimes in both the United States and Mexico. The controversy has sparked calls for the resignation of ATF Director Kenneth Melson. But according to testimony given by Melson in private to congressional investigators, the inquiries should look beyond the ATF. A letter sent this week to Attorney General Eric Holder by Congressmembers Daryl Issa and Charles Grassley outlined some of the key points of the meeting with the ATF director. The Congressmembers wrote they have, quote, very real indications from several sources that some of the gun trafficking higher-ups that the ATF sought to identify were already known to other agencies and may even have been paid as informants. The agencies named in the letter are the FBI and the DEA. Both are agencies that, like ATF, fall under the umbrella of the Department of Justice. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Many residents of New Orleans and the surrounding parishes are still struggling to rebuild their homes more than 5 years after Hurricane Katrina and faulty levees devastated the city. The challenge of rebuilding has been particularly difficult for some lower-income minority homeowners who were often given far less federal help than residents from wealthy neighborhoods. A discrimination lawsuit settled Wednesday with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development aimed to address this issue. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has more from New Orleans.
The case alleged that Louisiana's Road Home Program, which aimed to help homeowners rebuild after Hurricane Katrina, used a discriminatory formula to calculate awards. Grants were based either on a home's pre-storm value or the cost of rebuilding, whichever was lower. Because of this, homeowners from low-income neighborhoods often didn't receive sufficient money to rebuild. In the wake of the storm, largely African-American neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth Ward and New Orleans East have struggled. The Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center says that under the settlement, more than 13,000 homeowners will now receive full compensation. More than $60 million in additional grants will be allocated to help the rebuilding process. Additionally, the agreement grants homeowners more time to rebuild without the threat of foreclosure. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And finally, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals says the U.S. military must stop enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Last November, a federal judge ruled that the policy was unconstitutional and ordered it stopped. Upon appeal, the court stayed the ruling, but yesterday lifted that stay, meaning the ban on Don't Ask, Don't Tell would once again be in effect. In its ruling, the court cited the recent opinion of the Justice Department saying laws targeting gays and lesbians must be held to heightened scrutiny. In the order, the court said the arguments to keep the discriminatory policy in place do not hold up to the new higher standard. The case will be heard by the court in late August. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily news headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Martin Lemlin. Now let's take a look at our own headlines. In local and campus news, a BC coroner report says that the death of a 20-year-old UBC student was caused by a cocaine-induced heart attack. Silas Rogers was found dead in his residence last year after partying and taking in the festivities of the 2010 Olympics. On February 24th, Rogers was arrested by Whistler police for public intoxication. It's believed that he was released the next day, continued to party, and then was found unresponsive in his UBC residence on February 26th. BC coroner announced yesterday that his death was due to acute myocardial infarction due to cocaine intoxication. BC's Environmental Assessment Office might not be doing an adequate job. BC's Auditor General, John Doyle, released a report yesterday saying that the Environmental Assessment Office, or EAO, isn't doing a satisfactory job in monitoring its certified projects. Now, what the EAO does, it reviews proposals for major industrial projects like mines and power plants, and then issues a certificate of approval if the office is satisfied that the project is going to meet the province's environmental standards. But Doyle says he isn't satisfied with the EAO's follow-ups after it's issued its approval. The Auditor General goes on to say that acceptable monitoring and enforcement of certified projects is not happening, and that follow-up evaluations aren't even taking place. Since these evaluations aren't happening consistently, Doyle believes that the EAO can't assure British Columbians that our environmental standards are being met. Now, Doyle's report included 6 recommendations to improve the office, which included clarifying the responsibilities of officers in post-certifications inspections and conducting those evaluations to make sure that projects are indeed honoring the environmental guidelines. What the Auditor General does is a nonpartisan officer who directly reports to the Legislative Assembly regarding the performance of various government programs. The EAO has already acknowledged the report and appointed a Director of Strategy to make sure that oversight is in fact being improved. A Mexican couple got creative in a recent jailbreak. Maria Del Mar Aronia was stopped by guards in a Chetumal prison when they saw her struggling with her suitcase. The 19-year-old had been visiting her husband, Edwin Valdemar Antiaga Perez, who was serving 20 years for various and undisclosed crimes. Since Miss Aronia had gone to jail for a conjugal visit with her husband, she was allowed to bring the bag with her, but when the guards asked Aronia to open the case, they found her husband curled up inside. Perez was promptly brought back to his cell. Aronia was also detained by authorities. We're going to take a quick break, but please stay with us. I'm Martin Lemlin, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
What is that? What is it? One more shot and salute.
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end.
Go again.
Got your mind, I brought you well. Got your mama, got you well.
This music, reggae music, is tell you, I tell the whole world, you know. Telepathically and physically and mentally and spiritually, I tell them to this music, yeah.
So you heard it here at Rocker Show 101.9 FM CITR. Featuring yours truly, George Beard, keeping the reggae music alive on the west coast of Canada. It's all about roots rock, lovers rock, dancehall, reggae music. On CITR Rocker Show, Sunday noon to 3 p.m. each and every Sunday.
The love of Jack.
For over 25 years of doing it nice, warm, and easy. Until next time, such thank you to faith and spread it gently. Jah bless and Jah guidance. Jah out.
I'm looking at me.
Bless out.
Your mind on the rhythm and a wine in a ace. Glad I'm up here in a rubber dump place. Dance out.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. We're broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Now we're going to continue with some coverage of the HST. The Fight HST campaign has called in police to investigate potentially professional alteration of its campaign signs on Vancouver Island, as well as filed police reports over more sign thefts throughout Vancouver. Fight HST leader Bill Vanderzam stressed that due to minimal funding, his campaign has remained fairly low profile, and that the lawn signs are one of the campaign's best tools in clarifying the fact that a yes vote is in fact a vote to get rid of the HST.
We've had to rely much on volunteers getting the message out with the brochures, and we've had to depend on our lawn signs, our signs. Our sign campaign has been fairly effective. They're all over the province, but we've suffered something that we've never seen in this proportion previously anywhere.
It's being reported that a number of Fight HST signs have been altered to change the message on the signs from vote yes to vote no, and from extinguish the HST to extinguish the PST.
So they've doctored these signs. It's been happening mostly on Vancouver Island, and we hope that's where it'll stop, and possibly we've helped nip it in the bud. We're seeing it on Vancouver Island. We've lodged our complaints, the RCMP in Ladysmith, Nanaimo, and Parksville, and they're taking this very seriously. They're acting acting on it because it's definitely a crime. It's fraudulent to do this.
Fight HSD campaigner Bill Tillman went on to explain exactly what happened to the signs.
Could I just add, just to make sure that you understand how professionally, these are vinyl stickers. This no is matching the font, the typeface exactly as previously seen on these signs. It's changed the P from the HSD to PSD in two locations. And this wasn't just done by somebody with a magic marker. This is a professional printing job to make these stickers up, and we found them on at least three or more signs so far. We don't know how many because many of them are on the highway, but someone has gone to an incredible amount of trouble to print these things up. And we're hoping that if a printer did this unknowingly and actually supplied things like this, but didn't know they were for this criminal purpose, that they will come forward and report it to the police or report it to us, because this is unprecedented in my experience.
Although for Mr. Van Der Zandt, it seems more an issue of letting the democratic process breathe, of general honesty in this referendum.
It's an attack on the democratic process, and it needs to be stopped, and it needs to be stopped now.
Van Der Zandt only seems to believe that the historical significance of this referendum is being undermined by these mischievous acts.
Because we've got it. This is a democratic process such as we've never seen it practiced anywhere in the country. It's important that it's allowed to work and allowed to work fairly. And when you get misleading advertising or get people doctoring signs or pulling up signs, that's not helping the democratic process. It's not helping either side. That's not good. We want to make it work. We want to see it work fairly and honestly. Fairly and honestly. That's all we ask.
There's also the state of confusion that some of the advertising campaigns of the government are causing. Van Der Zandt claims that the campaigns are causing confusion as to what a yes vote is actually going for, and would like to have it clarified that a vote yes is a vote to extinguish the HST, and a vote no is to keep the HST in place.
And a lot of people are calling us about the ads and wondering what it is or why it is, and it's definitely, again, an attack on the democratic process once more, and we've lodged a complaint with the ombudsperson. We're hoping to hear this week as to what can be done. We previously approached the Canadian Ads Council, and they can't do anything because they deem it to be a political thing, so our only last resort was with the ombudsperson.
The altered signs were found this week by volunteers in Nanaimo, Ladysmith, and Campbell River. The HST referendum dates have been extended. You now have until July 22nd to request a package if you haven't received one yet. The number to call to request a package at Elections BC is 1-800-661-8683. You have until 4:30 p.m. on August 5th to return the package to Elections BC. It's now time to turn things over to Groundwire for their weekly newscast. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemelin.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news. This week's episode of Groundwire is produced on Sinek's traditional territory in the studios of CJLY, a cooperative community station in Nelson, British Columbia. In this edition, Bill Lightbone, a volunteer at Vancouver Co-op Radio, speaks about the release of the final report of the Davies Commission of Inquiry into the death of Frank Paul. Groundwire's Carly Forbes reports on the appeal of the successful charter challenge instigated by three sex workers in Ontario by the federal and Ontario governments. We also have an update on the search for Nesky Manuel. Nesky's body was found on June 29th on the shores of the South Thompson River downstream from Nisqually Reserve in Suwamish Territory in Interior British Columbia. You just heard from Keoki Takahashi and the band Radio with the song Ghost ESP Revelations. It's available on the anthology Matsuri, a collection of works by Japanese-Canadian musicians and composers.
Here are this week's headlines. Shelley Sillars, president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers Local 546 in Guelph, speaks about the federal government's back-to-work bill recently introduced by Federal Labour Minister Lisa Raitt. Entitled the Restoring Mail Delivery for Canadians Act, The union says that the bill denies 48,000 Canadian postal workers the right to free collective bargaining and that the action is unnecessary, unjust, and counterproductive.
The precedent that's just been set through this back-to-work legislation is actually a very scary one. This isn't just about Canadian Union of Postal Workers. This is about all workers. I think the Harper government is trying to send a clear message to unions and to workers everywhere that, you know, you either accept the lowball offer that the corporation will put on the table the first time, or, you know, the government will intervene and they will legislate a collective agreement. The Harper government is taking away the right to collective bargaining, which is a right that all Canadians have and all unions have. But unfortunately for the postal workers, I do believe that we were the example. We were pretty much the first. CAW, under the threat of back-to-work legislation with the Air Canada workers, accepted a really inferior offer, I believe, because they were afraid of what would happen with the legislation. And what just happened to the postal workers proves that they had a right to be afraid.
Thanks to Carly Forbes from CFRU for files for this story.
Asbestos is a fire-retardant construction material. Once popular, it is now banned in 52 countries worldwide and effectively banned in Canada through tight restrictions. This is due to the severe health problems associated with asbestos, with the World Health Organization claiming that at least 90,000 die every year from asbestos-related lung cancer, mesothelioma, and asbestosis resulting from occupational exposures. For this reason, the government has poured tens of millions of dollars into removing asbestos from public buildings like schools and the parliament. 24 Sussex Drive in Ottawa, Stephen Harper's residence, is also being stripped of the harmful substance. Despite this, and contrary to the advice and urgings of Health Canada and hundreds of other organizations worldwide, Canada blocked an attempt by the UN to list asbestos as a hazardous chemical at the Rotterdam Convention meetings in Geneva in late June. The convention needed a consensus for the listing to go ahead. Adding asbestos to the list would have required those importing the substance be informed of the risks as well as agree to follow costly safety protocols in handling the asbestos, which wouldn't have been good news for the Canadian asbestos industry. Although our country recognizes the devastating outcomes of asbestos at home, we continue to export $90 million worth each year from two mines in Quebec, almost all of which is exported to developing countries. New Democrat MP Pat Martin spoke out against the government's decision in Geneva, saying, quote, "Asbestos is the greatest industrial killer the world has ever known. More people die from asbestos than all industrial causes combined, yet Canada continues to be one of the largest producers and exporters in the world. We are exporting human misery on a monumental scale. Our position is morally and ethically reprehensible," end quote. When challenged over this controversial blockage of adding asbestos to the UN's list of hazardous chemicals, Industry Minister Christian Paradis has maintained that asbestos can be used in safe and controlled ways. This is, of course, exactly what would be regulated by the listing, as it would require importers to follow guidelines to meet the standard. But this is as close to an explanation as the Conservative government is willing to give. I'm Sam Kerviak from CJSR in Edmonton, reporting for Groundwire.
July 1st was the 28th anniversary of Canada's Access to Information Act coming into force. The legislation requires almost 200 departments in the federal government to give any information they hold, with only a few exceptions, to anyone in Canada. According to the Supreme Court of Canada, the purpose of the act is to facilitate democracy. Dr. Mark Weiler worries that our democracy is still in crisis, in part because we don't use access to information.
If you filled a room with 1,200 adults, about 740 would have voted, but on average, only one would have used their access rights.
Dr. Weiler started using his access rights while doing doctoral research. For him, public education is part of the solution.
We're the first generation in Canadian history to have this right, so it's not easy to find someone who will teach us.
For those wanting to learn how to use their access to information rights, Dr. Weiler suggests starting with fairly uncontentious requests, like a department's procedural manual, or a list of what others have requested about a certain topic.
Manuals give clues as to how a department is supposed to work, while lists of previous ATIs received by the department give you a clue as to what can be ordered.
Some types of information can be harder to get than others, but Dr. Weiler says the government's attitude is not the main barrier.
If people think about the Access to Information Act, they seem to use the mentality of an adult. They have a strong sense of certainty that it won't work, or are devoid of any kind of depth of curiosity, like that they wouldn't use it. We might have better luck learning how to use it if we approached it with the mind of a child, with a deeply seated sense of wonder.
To awaken your sense of wonder, Dr. Weiler has created an educational video that includes an example of a real Access to Information request and also a computer-animated movie.
The cartoon is about a Freedom of Information mage on an epic quest into an unknown land, the government of Canada. And it's meant to be entertaining while giving a few tips here and there about using the Access to Information Act.
If you want to learn more about the Access to Information Act and watch the educational video, go to Dr. Weiler's website at www.opengovernmentrecords.net.
A group is currently walking from Vancouver to Ottawa in the 2011 Walk for Justice with the purpose of raising awareness and demanding justice, closure, equality, and accountability for Canada's missing and murdered women and their families. Gladys Radek and Bernie Williams co-founded the walk in 2008, and since then they've walked from Kamloops to Winnipeg in 2010 and from Vancouver to Prince Rupert in 2009. This year, once they arrive in Ottawa, after walking across Canada from June until September, they will call on Prime Minister Stephen Harper to hold a National Missing and Murdered Women Symposium in Vancouver, significant for its connection to the Picton murders and to the Highway of Tears. They are looking for accountability as well as an acknowledgement of racism and the sexist and racist systems in our country that have led to such an extensive number of deaths. For more information about the walk, including the two routes being followed, please visit fnbc.info/walk4justice.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Was Dallas Arcand with Quentin Tutusis and Don Demaray from the album Modern Day Warrior. Our first feature in this edition of Groundwire is about the release of the final report of the Davies Commission of Inquiry into the death of Frank Paul. At 8:18 p.m. on December 5, 1998, Frank Joseph Paul, a 47-year-old Mi'kmaq First Nations man living in Vancouver, was arrested in the downtown East Side by two Vancouver police officers for being intoxicated in a public place. He was taken to a Vancouver jail facility. Several minutes later, he was removed from the lockup, placed in a police van, and left in an alleyway in East Vancouver. Mr. Paul's body was found at the same location at 2:41 a.m. the following morning. According to the autopsy report, death was attributed to hypothermia due to acute alcohol intoxication. The coroner decided against calling a coroner's inquest, choosing instead to conduct an inquiry without a jury under Section 20 of the Coroner's Act. In the year 2000, the Vancouver Police Department concluded disciplinary proceedings against two officers involved in the case. One officer was suspended for 2 days for discreditable conduct, and the other officer was suspended for 1 day for neglect of duty. On several occasions, the Criminal Justice Branch of the Ministry of Attorney General examined the circumstances surrounding Mr. Paul's death. In each review, the branch decided not to proceed with criminal charges against any of the police officers involved. On February 22, 2007, the Solicitor General announced a public inquiry into the Frank Paul case. On March 9, 2007, he announced that William H. Davies, Queen's Counsel, would act as commissioner. Justice Davies eventually produced two reports on the Frank Paul case, the second of which was released just last week. Bill Lightbone, co-host of Late Nights with Savages on CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, has been following the case closely, and he shared perspectives on the reports, the public inquiry, and the Vancouver Police Department with Co-op listeners recently. On the topic of Justice Davies and the public inquiry, Lightbone had this to say.
I myself still have a great deal of faith in Justice Davies. He did an excellent job as far as I'm concerned. And he was very fair-minded in the whole process. And he was very inquiring in regards to what really went on there. And, you know, there was a lot of the truth of what goes on with our police department here in Vancouver that came out in that particular hearing. And it gave the citizens of Vancouver an opportunity to see where there could be and should be a whole lot of improvements made in regards to how the Vancouver Police Department operates in Vancouver.
The first Davies report looked into the facts surrounding Frank Paul's death and the responses of all relevant official bodies except for the Criminal Justice Branch. This was because the Criminal Justice Branch challenged the inquiry's authority to inquire into matters of prosecutorial discretion. The BC Court of Appeal eventually clarified that with some restrictions, Justice Davies' inquiry into the death of Frank Paul could proceed. The report suggested that, while Davies does not suggest that the Vancouver Police Department conducted themselves improperly in the investigation of the death of Frank Paul, he does recommend that the police no longer investigate their own conduct in cases like these. Davies' second recommendation was that more needs to be done to meet the needs of Vancouver's homeless or alcoholic citizens, suggesting that the Vancouver Police Department's drunk tank be replaced by a variety of medical treatment options and an increase in low-barrier housing designed for the specific needs of chronic alcoholics. While expressing confidence in Justice Davies, Bill Lightbone remarks on the way that the Vancouver police officers that could have been charged in the death of Frank Paul were
highly protected by the prosecutors. As a matter of fact, I might also add here that three of the prosecutors that were involved in this whole process refused to testify, and the government of British Columbia protected those people. And in fact, the commissioner, Davies, was forced to take the government to court, and the court ordered those prosecutors to appear.
Bill Lightbone also has this to say about the great concern in the Aboriginal community about how the Frank Paul case was handled by the VPD.
As a citizen of British Columbia and as an Aboriginal person, of course, people probably realize that Frank Paul was of Aboriginal ancestry. And in fact, it is of major concern to the Aboriginal community the way that whole issue was handled. And I have to admit that Justice Davies was just as perturbed or almost as perturbed as the Aboriginal community in the way the whole thing was handled. And there was a very real effort, at least an apparent effort, to try and cover up for the police officers that were involved. And in my estimation, it was a racist attitude that really created the problem here. And the fact that Frank Paul was just another drunken Indian and of no major concern to the police department and those other people that were responsible for dealing with him and with the issue itself.
This is Catherine Fisher reporting for Groundwire. Thanks to Bill Lightbone and Gennarji O'Sullivan for files on this story.
In September 2010, Justice Himmel ruled to decriminalize sex work. The following day, the federal and provincial governments both appealed this ruling. From June 13th to 17th, the appeal was heard in court in front of a 5-judge panel with 7 interveners. Fred Chatbot, a member of POWER, an Ottawa sex workers organization, discusses the appeal.
What happened is that 2 hours later, both governments, so the Ontario government and the federal government, appealed the decision, and so the appeal was to take place about 6 or 7 months later. It ended up happening in June. So June 13th to June 17th. And at that point, it opens the door to interveners to come in. So interveners are stakeholders who have something to add to the case or have a position on the ruling and would have to add their argument to the entire case that is already existent.
Power teamed up with Maggie's of Toronto to intervene in this case on behalf of sex workers.
One statement that certainly was sticking out was Cynthia, our lawyer, told the court that not only is sex work not valued in society, sex workers are not valued. I mean, sex work is kind of a concept, like the actual people who are on the receiving end of those statements and those laws and that position from the government are sex workers themselves, right? So to put it bluntly, she said, nobody cares, the state doesn't care, and it's reflected in these laws, and it's reflected in the position they adopted in this court case.
Sandra Calhoun-Chu, a senior policy analyst from the Canadian HIV Legal AIDS Network, discusses their stance as interveners.
We found evidence that, outreach workers who distribute lube and condoms and other safer sex materials and literature were having a hard time accessing sex workers because they're being policed so heavily that they're not, you know, in places that it's easy to find for outreach workers to get in touch with them. The communicating provision in the criminal code, which prevents people from communicating in public for the purpose of prostitution, there's a lot of evidence that was presented that was about how it prevents sex workers from screening clients.
Right.
And what we said was, like, that's a huge harm to sex workers, but it also prevents you from negotiating the terms of what you're willing to do and whether you're willing to practice safer sex. So there's evidence that condom use is less likely to be enforced if you're not able to talk about it beforehand. And another issue that was sort of tangential to that was the fact that a lot of sex workers testified, or there was evidence at the trial record, that healthcare staff and professionals are very discriminatory towards sex workers. They face a lot of stigma. And we said that the law contributes to that stigma and therefore making it harder for sex workers to access professional and non-discriminatory healthcare that addresses their particular needs.
Amy Levovich, one of the plaintiffs in the case, talks about why it's so important for sex workers to be at the forefront of the discussion around decriminalization.
The removal of the laws and what they've done in New South Wales, Australia, and New Zealand is rational and regulation that makes sense and that people come to a consensus about, right? Sex workers being at the forefront of that discussion, and is a step in the right direction as far as also the discussion around that this is a choice for a lot of people, and it starts the discussion and it breaks down sort of the barriers that people have in their mind about what sex work and sex workers are.
Now that the appeal hearing has concluded, it will be another 6 months or more before any decision is released. Fred from Power talks about what the wait means for sex workers.
If it's a smaller case, there are three judges. This time there are five. And I got different feelings of judges' positions on the matter. So I'm sure they'll have a lot of work to do in terms of writing a decision for this. So I'm not expecting it to come out before Christmas. Like, it's probably going to be between Christmas and in a year. But personally, I find it really upsetting that it takes so long and the laws are stayed in the meantime because it's going to affect so many people's lives. And I mean, these laws contribute to so much violence experienced by sex workers, especially street-based sex workers, that for me it's on the offensive side that we're keeping these laws in the meantime when there's so much evidence that shows that they contribute to the violence and the vulnerability to violence.
I'm Carly Forbes from CFRU in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire.
With us, when a person enters our house, he becomes our guest. We must treat him hospitably as long as he shows no hostile intentions. At the same time, we expect him to return to us equal treatment for what he receives. Some of our chiefs said, these people wish to be partners with us in our country. We must therefore be the same as brothers to them and live as one family. We will share equally in everything, half and half, in land, water, and timber, etc. What is ours will be theirs, and what is theirs will be ours. We will help each other to be great and good.
That is the voice of Nesky Manuel, taken from a documentary on the 100th anniversary of the Laurier Memorial. Written in the form of a letter, The memorial was dictated by the chiefs of the Suwepmek, Nkamup, and Okanagan Nations to their secretary, James Tate, a young Scot who settled at Spence's Bridge along the Thompson River. This documentary was featured on Groundwire last year. Neske Manuel went missing on Sunday, May 8th, from his family's camping ground near Nisqually Lake. His body was found June 25th by a local rancher on the shore of the South Thompson River near Pritchard. On June 29th, what would have been Neske's 30th birthday, the Shuswap Nation Tribal Council sent out a press release about Neske's death. Neske was known to many of us in community radio. He contributed a music show on CFBX, a campus station in Kamloops, from 2004 to 2005. In 2007, he produced a spoken word show with a focus on Aboriginal news and Suwepmek language and culture. He started Suwepmek Radio in his home territory. In 2008, Neske was hired as an Aboriginal programming coordinator at CKDU in Halifax. He was an active member of the NCRA Native Caucus. His work has been featured on Groundwire, and he contributed an essay about Suwepmek Radio to Islands of Resistance, a book about pirate radio in Canada. Neske was passionate about the Suwepmek language and worked on translating the Linux operating system into Suwepmisen for School District 73. He was also a member of the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty. He was an avid runner and cyclist who once rode across Canada on his single-speed bike. He served on the Nisqually Band Council. On the day Neske's death was announced by the Shuswap Nation Tribal Council, Gunarji O'Sullivan, co-host of the Vancouver Co-op radio program Late Nights with Savages, read from the press release. Here is a short excerpt.
Neske always welcomed people into the circle. It's important that we found him, said Shuswap man Randy Sam. Neske is part of who we are, a gift from Creator who touched many people. We'll always hold him up as someone special to us. We call the people from all nations to come forward to stand with the support of Neske's beloved family and his friends at this time, said Chief Krishtan. Neske was open to life and the lessons it brings. We will all learn from this experience, and we will find our way as spiritual people to be thankful for our time with Neske and to live our lives to the fullest, safe in the knowledge that Neske will always be a part of the circle.
Yo, this one here goes out to the struggle in the tradition of the old poets. Yo, the nation of poets. We haven't forgotten that. Yo, in the tradition of Aresi Sekarshe, God bless his soul, I want to say something to you. My friends around the mic. Until the lion learns to speak, the tales of hunting will be weak. My poetry hails within the streets. My poetry fails to be discreet. It travels across the earth and seas, from Eritrea to the West Indies. It knows no boundaries, no cheese. It's studied in parts of Greece. I'm sick as far as lyrics, not with as far as gimmicks. I spit barrage and limit. They talk and rip it. I'm hip, the hop is living. I skip the hop. Obvious women don't get what I'm presenting. No rims, my mind is spinning. I was born and raised in a place where the tone of flame would blaze, where the foreigners not embrace, where they warn you jock and pace, where the loners lower their gaze, where the corners slower to chase, where they twist and turn in the maze, with a pistol upon your face.
That was Kanan with Until the Lion Learns to Speak from his album, The Dusty Foot Philosopher.
And now for Groundwire's community radio report. The Salmo Radio Society, broadcasting as CFAD, is a very small community radio station in British Columbia's mountainous interior region. Located in Salmo, BC, a village with a population of about 1,000 people, CFAD has about 12 volunteers and currently broadcasts to its community at just 5 watts. Catherine Fisher, a volunteer at nearby Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC, brings us this short report about CFAD and its plans to expand its operation.
Kootenai Co-op Radio volunteer Brigitte Huss spoke recently with Gerald Hutchman, also known as Hutch, of the Salmo Radio Society, about Salmo Radio's plans to expand their signal and go from having a developmental license to having a fully licensed radio station in Salmo, BC.
We're applying for our permit license. Of course, that'll determine what happens, you know, whether we can continue forward. I'm really hoping that we can do a lot more towards promotion of the radio station. I'm hoping that when we get this new license, one of the things that's happening there is we're going to increase our signal significantly. So right now, we're broadcasting in a blistering 5 watts, and that only gets about 7 kilometers out. And in the mountains here, it's tough. But with our new license, we'll be increasing that 150 watts, and so we're hoping to reach about a 20-kilometer radius.
Running a radio station in such a small place has some unique challenges. It's very difficult to get volunteers. There's very little money in the community often for it. Brigitte asked Hutch why he feels there should be a community radio station in Salmo.
I'm passionate about it. I mean, there's some things that happen here in Salmo that I think are very important, and I have a great passion for it, and I think that's what keeps me going.
The Salmo Radio Society is about halfway to its goal of $20,000, which will allow it to expand its signal to 20 kilometers.
Thanks to Brigitte Hoos of Kootenai Co-op Radio for files.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, which was produced on Sinek's traditional territory in the studios of CJLY, a cooperative community station in Nelson, B.C.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Monica Roche.
And I'm Catherine Fisher.
Headlines this week were written by Frieda Werden, Sam Kerviak, Carly Forbes, and Catherine Fisher.
We'd also like to thank Gennargio O'Sullivan, Bill Lightbone, and Brigitte Hoos. Music in this issue was by Dallas Arcand and Kanan.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Thanks to Groundwire for that. You can catch their radio programs featuring headlines, reports, and features at ncra.ca/groundwire. Going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Going to be talking to James Kronk about this summer's season of Theater Under the Stars. Listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver. Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts on Commercial Drive at Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore. You'll also save online at Band March Canada and Big Mama. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
For 7 days in July, Vancouver will play host to another international gathering of sports enthusiasts as we host the North American Out Games. The Out Games will feature 18 different sports, from badminton to poker to hockey. The games will also include the Human Rights Conference, with workshops on diversity and an awards ceremony recognizing individuals and corporations that have influenced LGBTQ rights. Scheduled events during week-long games include a job fair, the Miss Gay and Lesbian Sports Association pageant, cultural activities, and the most amazing closing ceremonies you've ever laid witness to. The event will come to a close with a march of athletes in the world-famous 2011 Vancouver Pride Parade. Catch all the festivities, events, and parties at www.vancouver2011outgames.com. Listen to our live broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, or check out our live stream at www.citr.ca and www.queerfmvancouver.com.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Theatre Under the Stars has been operating for over 60 years now, putting on quality productions at a reasonable price. And this year they're doing something special for students, offering very inexpensive rates for anyone who's willing to go. I had a chance to speak with James Kronk, the managing producer for Theatre Under the Stars, or TUTS for short. He told me all about what we have in store this season. James, thanks a lot for talking to us. How's the production for Theater Under the Stars going so far?
Well, we don't open until July the 8th, and it's a busy time this time of the year, so we're excited about it. Can't wait.
What shows are you guys doing this season?
Well, this year we're doing Anything Goes, the wonderful kind of Cole Porter musical with all the fantastic music and songs and dancing. And the other show we're doing is a lot of fun rock and roll, Bye Bye Birdie.
And this is all going down to the Malkin Bowl?
It's all at Theater of the Stars, yeah, which is Malkin Bowl in Stanley Park. This is our 65th season.
Has Toots always held their performances at the Malkin Bowl?
It's always been in Malkin Bowl, you bet. And you know, Toots, this life of Toots, Theater Under the Stars, started in 1940, and we've been going strong for many, many years, and love putting on family musical theaters.
And what are you guys offering to students this year?
Well, last year we had a new season sponsor come on board, which was TD, and you know, TD has a desire and a mandate as well as Theater on the Stars to provide kind of access to young people to kind of experience music, and certainly for us, musical theater. So we've got a wonderful program called Students or Stars Seating, and what it means is that any student with an ID card can come to the box office the day of a performance and pay $20. To see a show and get you know, lots of different seats in the theater, and great seats, and for $20. And our normal ticket prices range up to $44, so it's a great deal for students.
And that's generally the way you can pick up tickets, just show up the day of?
Yeah, you know, Theater of the Stars has 1,200 seats, so it's never very rare that we would ever sell out until the end of the season, maybe. So you can just show up and buy tickets when you are at the door. The box office opens at kind of 2 in the afternoon, and that's how many people buy tickets. But you can also obviously go online, tuts.ca. But to get the students rate, the $20 students rate, you just show up at the box office the day of a performance.
So the big preview night starts Friday, the 8th. When do you guys close up shop for the season?
August the 20th. So Bye Bye Birdie starts on July the 8th, and then that runs every even day in July and odd days in August, and Anything Goes alternates. So Anything Goes opens on July the 9th, and then alternates on odd days in July and even days in August until August 20th.
I've never actually been to the Malkin Bowl, but I'm told it's one of the greatest venues the city has.
You know, Malkin Bowl is this unbelievable, iconic, you know, hidden gem in Stanley Park. And